Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, let's turn to the medical side of this. This was a story that was one of the first I read this morning, in part because of its writer, Robert Langreth. He joins us on the phone from Massachusetts. He and the team have been doing just some phenomenal work. It really helps us understand the complexities, but also both the potentials and the challenges of where we go here medically. He joins us as well as Joel Weber, the editor, of course, of Bloomberg Business Week. Joel's on the phone from Brooklyn. Joel, I want to start with you because you guys have done a really nice job of keeping the medical piece of this front and center, even going back, gosh, it's like five, six, however many weeks ago with some of the great cover stories. I've lost track of time, bro. But help tee this up for us.
Yeah, so you're right. This is sort of one of the beats that we kind of keep coming to in our coverage, which is we look at the fallout and the companies, and we got to come back and talk about the science and the tech. Regeneron is really the subject of this story, and Bob and Susan have just been this amazing duo throughout this process. And you know, we sat them down back when we could sit down together, and it feels like so long ago, Jason, to your point. And we said, what is the body of work that you guys want to be working on? And they basically just ticked through a bunch of ideas, and we said, go get it. And it turned out that Regeneron, of all of them, was actually sort of in our backyard here in New York. The company's based in Westchester. This is obviously a company that has just surged this year, top performing company year to date. And it's all because of these antibody treatments that they're developing. And Bob, why is that cause for hope?
Well, so basically, you know, the reason is that this virus, this COVID, you know, it's looking increasingly obvious, like it's not going away anytime soon. And we're really going to need to develop custom treatments against this. That is, drugs that are specifically designed to target this COVID, because the vaccine might take a while. And these antibodies that Regeneron is developing, those are likely to be some of the first custom-designed drugs that could come out against this coronavirus. And Regeneron, in particular, has been working on antibodies for a lot of diseases for a long time, but they've been, even though they don't sell any drugs for infections now, they've been quietly working on antibodies for various infections for a long time. And they had, right literally a month or two before the coronavirus happened, they had the most successful trial in the history of Ebola treatment, and that was their antibody cocktail. Now they're trying to do the same, what they did with Ebola, for the coronavirus, devise antibodies that would block the key spike proteins on the top of the virus and basically neutralize the virus. And you could inject this in and use it either potentially as a treatment for sick patients or kind of as a prophylactic for like high-risk workers like doctors and nurses and people kind of going into the line of fire.
How difficult is it, Bob, to get to it? Like, in other words, to get finally an antibody treatment that actually works? We've got lots of folks working on it, but it sounds like that there's a fair amount of failure to be expected along the way.
Like anything in drug development, there's absolutely no guarantee it'll work. There could be, you know, side effects that, you know, they don't expect. But you know, there's absolutely no guarantee that, you know, that's one reason why there's actually several companies working on it. So Regeneron's one doesn't work out. There's AstraZeneca. There's a company called Vir Biotechnology. Eli Lilly's working on it. So there's like several kind of efforts that are like semi competing with the other parallel efforts. So there's like several kind of shots on goal is kind of what they call it. But there is reason to be hopeful that the antibody treatment, you know, has a you know, better odds of success than some other, you know, treatments. And one reason is it does have this track record. It worked against Ebola and some particularly tough viral diseases. And we quote in our story the former head of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, saying, you know, if I had to bet on any one drug treatment working out and being able to help, it would be some of these antibody drugs. So, because the technology has really, you know, increased amazingly in speed and specificity over the years.
Say you're able to, you know, say that this proves, you know, as promising as everyone sort of expects. How would Regeneron go about scaling it?
Yeah, so that is one definite question that we do raise in the story about the antibodies. And historically, you know, antibodies are kind of niche drugs. They're very expensive specialty drugs for things like lung cancer and you know, autoimmune diseases that are very expensive and used by, you know, a small segment of the population. So definitely, you know, if this works, this will definitely strain the manufacturing capacity. They were talking about by August maybe having the capacity to produce either 20,000 treatments a month or 200,000, like, prophylactic treatments a month. So obviously, you know, if this thing is still going strong, that's like almost like a drop in the bucket. And there's been, apparently, we also discussed in the story, there's like discussions, informal discussions among drug companies and nonprofits saying, hey, if your one works out but mine doesn't, like maybe we could all kind of combine our manufacturing capacity to be able to make more of it. So that's an absolutely key question, you know, with any of this stuff, you know, if it works, will they be able to make enough?
Well, and I do wonder about that sort of collaboration and competition and everything that normally happens in this world. How has that changed as you look across this entire industry, Bob?
Well, I mean, you know, the different companies, you know, as we look at it, are still, you know, doing different efforts on antibodies and slightly different approaches. So a lot of different companies doing different things. What's new and what's different is there kind of is more of a spirit of like, you know, keeping in touch with the, you know, what would normally be your competitor and talking to them about, you know, you're doing X and I'm doing Y, and like, how might we work together? And, you know, if we need to work together, you know, we will. So there is kind of this feeling that, you know, some companies, you know, may need to donate kind of manufacturing capacity to whatever turns out to work, you know, and not sit on it. You know, if someone else's drug works and yours doesn't, you may need to kind of, you know, donate your manufacturing capacity to the cause in some way and, you know, not be worried by the fact that it's someone else's drug that's the one that turned out to work. And that's the kind of discussions that we're hearing are going on right now. Now, there's nothing specific into place because none of these things have, you know, have worked yet, so we don't know. And so for the time being, it's good that, you know, Regeneron has a lot of other companies are, you know, working on similar type drugs. So, you know, you just can't predict which of these things is going to work till you test them.
So, and I do think about, we just talked with the CEO of Intercontinental Hotels, like thinking about, you know, it will be steps. We hear it from our policymakers, Bob, you know, steps in kind of getting us back to normal. And even if it's not a vaccine, this may be one of the things that starts to help communities. I think you end your story, you know, help communities return to a semi-normal state until a vaccine is finally available. And just got about 30 seconds here. That's what the drug industry, like, we need to be thinking, right? How do we take those steps? And the drug industry is crucial in all of this.
Right. So none of these drugs in development really will replace the ultimate need for a vaccine. But I think the idea is, and the thought we do end the story on, is that if you can get some treatment that kind of takes the edge off this a little bit, maybe, you know, takes off the worst consequences or helps protect some of the key essential workers, you know, then it'll be easier to kind of end some of the, or lessen some of the social distancing until mm-hmm. that time when we finally get a vaccine.
All right. Thank you so much. This is a must read. I'll put it out on Twitter for everybody. It will also be in the magazine this week and on the terminal on Bloomberg.com. Bob Langreth, healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone, along with Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week magazine.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
We're also following big time the energy markets. And we do want to, in Business Week Economics at this hour, take a look at oil. An ounce of gold has never bought more barrels of crude in history. That fun fact coming from the Bloomberg, courtesy of Charlie Pellett. Let's talk about what's going on in the energy markets. Ellen Wald, certainly well known to our Bloomberg Radio and Bloomberg Business Week Radio audience, president of Transversal Consulting, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. She wrote the book Saudi Inc. on the history of Aramco and Saudi Arabia. She joins us on the phone from Jacksonville, Florida. Ellen, nice to have you here with us. I hope you're doing well and your family doing okay, staying safe.
Yes, we're all good here.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I do wonder, you know, we kicked off our show saying, you know, a penny for a barrel of oil, like you can't even get your head around that. Explain to me what is going on. Explain to our audience what's going on in the energy market right now. Is it all about just oversupply here?
Well, when the show started, it was a penny for a barrel of oil, and now the price has actually turned negative. But it's important to understand what we're actually talking about, because it's a big headline, oil prices turn negative. But what we're talking about very specifically is the price on WTI, which is the U.S. benchmark, West Texas International, the price for that contract that expires in May. And that contract expires tomorrow. So this is really the last day for trading on that particular oil for delivery in May. And so what this says is basically that everyone who wanted to buy oil for May has bought that oil and they don't want to buy any more of it. There's been fairly small trade volume in terms of trading oil on that May contract. If you look, in fact, at the June contract for WTI, it's actually much higher. It's in the 20s, not that that's a very high price, but it's much higher than a penny or negative prices. And there's much more volume on that contract. So as a result, the price for these May contracts just kept falling until it went negative. Now, does that mean that someone will pay you to buy oil? Not really. That's not really what it means, but essentially it means no one is interested in buying oil in the month of May or for the month of May, and also that there's very little storage capacity left to store that oil, because there have always been people out there who will buy oil and then store it in the hopes that they can sell it later for more money. And so the problem we're seeing is that demand for oil has dropped so precipitously, so fast, and so much
right.
that we're running out of places to store that oil. And so that's how you get in these situations like this one, where just at the end of that contract, it went negative.
And so what's interesting, Ellen, is as we look out, the oil futures market actually paints a picture of an economy that looks a little better by the end of the year. You get to sort of November-ish timeframe, and things seem a lot more rational. Keep me honest. Is that true? And how do we look at that as a barometer for the larger economy here?
Yeah, well, if you look at the contracts for WTI for November right now, or at least I'm looking at them as a bit, you know, an hour or two behind, but they're much higher. They're in the 30s. Now, that's not all that great,
right?
You know, for oil companies, but it's much better than what we're looking at for next month. And so that does say that at least in the longer term, we're looking at a growth in demand. Unless, you know, and I think that could change, because there's not a whole lot of buying and selling. There's not a whole lot of volume on those contracts, but what they're going for
right
now certainly says that demand should be higher.
Ellen, just got about 40 seconds left here. In terms of the longer play here, you know, there's talk about support for the American energy industry and certainly some of the shale players. Should that be done, or do you think we need to let the markets play their forces and kind of let it find where it should be settling on its own? Let market forces basically win here. And just got, forgive me, just about 25 seconds.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure for that, and there's a lot of pressure for that to happen. I think that it's not clear that anything that they can do will actually save jobs, and that it's probably best, and I do think the consensus now is that you've got to just let the market take its course.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. Really good to catch up with you, Ellen Wald. We were trying to sort of figure out our show today. Carol, you were the first to be like, let's just get Ellen Wald. She'll make sense of it all for us. And she did. We really appreciate it. President of Transversal Consulting, also a Bloomberg Opinion contributor, which is part of the reason we know she's so smart.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
We look around the world as we often do. We look to China and we look to one man to help us figure it all out. It's a big task, but man, he keeps proving up to it. Right, Carol?
Totally.
He's our guy. He's our guy, Andy Brown. He is the editorial director of Bloomberg New Economy.
Well, we'll see. We're bringing him in now.
Yeah, so a little pressure here. But a really fascinating column today, Andy, that we were reading, because you take us back to 91 when you moved to Beijing, a very different time, to say the least. And yet, a lot of people have been pointing back to that period because it was a little bit of a dark time, sort of like we're in now, and what came after was pretty remarable.
Right. Yeah. The reason I refer back to this is, you know, as you say, I moved to Beijing in 1991. This was 2 years after the People's Liberation Army had put down the Tiananmen Square pro-democracy protests, and you know, the conventional wisdom at that time among journalists and analysts was that China had set back its economic development by at least a generation. You know, in the foreign business community, much of the foreign business community had fled. I mean, the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, had drilled machine gun holes in one of the biggest hotels in Beijing, the China World Hotel, and some of the, at least one of the foreign diplomatic compounds where we ended up living. And, you know, American executives and their families were cowering in Hong Kong and Manila and elsewhere. And who knew, you know, right at that moment, China was on the cusp of the greatest economic expansion in history.
And it just skipped through from that moment, you know, pretty much every adversity that the world threw at it. You know, from the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s to SARS, the great recession in 2008, didn't slow down China one bit. But finally, this juggernaut has met its match in COVID-19, and this economy is shrinking. It really is a historic moment.
And yet, you're right. So right, like we know, this virus has, you know, Andy, upended kind of all of our projections about global growth, and certainly in terms of China's ambitions and their goals. And yet, you're right that even so, this has happened. We could see the pandemic speed China, along with the rest of Asia, their rise. Put that together for us.
Yeah, so by and large, the economies of East Asia have responded to coronavirus much better than economies in the West. So we know about the early Chinese missteps and cover-ups and blunderings, and the suppression of doctors and journalists who were warning about this. But it's sort of recovered and it's reopening, and South Korea and Taiwan and Singapore and Hong Kong, a number of these East Asian economies have come through. They've shown that they have competent, coordinated governments, that they embrace technology, particularly technologies that allow them to track and trace infections. They're nimble, they're agile, they're dynamic, like Asian companies. And it's hard not to come to the conclusion that, you know, at the New Economy Forum, we've always had a sense that we've always acknowledged the center of gravity of the global economy is moving east.
Right.
And it just seems as though this coronavirus has accelerated that trend.
And so, Andy, when you think about what that acceleration looks like and the trajectory of it, what is it, not to be too parochial here, but what does it mean for the United States?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is, to me, this is still all to play for. There are a lot of people who talk about the inevitability of a China century or, you know, an Asian century. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite buying it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting when you know, quite often from the outside, people looking outside of China, people looking in, they make China up to be this unstoppable juggernaut, you know. But when you actually live there, you become acutely aware of the monumental challenges and problems. You know, environment, demographic, and governance, and so on. And the opposite is true in America. You know, often people make the mistake of thinking that the United States is on this sort of inevitable trajectory, sunset trajectory. And then when you live here, you become aware of America's colossal advantages. Yeah. I mean, from its deep pools of capital to the best higher education in the world, the environment. I'm looking out right now over one of the most pristine bodies of water in the world, which is Lake Sunapee in New Hampshire. And China doesn't have a body of water anywhere close to this. So,
right.
You know, the issue really is how the West responds to this
right.
pandemic. Does it use it as an opportunity to
right.
renew, to rejuvenate, or not?
Well, like, I think about how I'm using this time to reset some things in my life, and I do wonder exactly what you're saying, Andy, of whether or not the United States and Europe use it as a reset for themselves. Jason,
well,
they say, as
Carol Masser goes, so goes China. So,
stop it.
Andy
Brown
listening.
Is the best of Bloomberg New Economy.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
Take a break. We can reach our destination.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for The Drive to the Close. Just about 11 minutes left in the trading day. Jeff Kruppelman is back with us, a friend of the show, chief investment strategist and head of equities at Marine Wealth Advisors. He joins us on the phone from Cincinnati, and that's exactly where the company is based. Jeff, nice to have you here again with us. How are you doing?
I think like everybody else, staying safe and kind of staying, I think, poised and focused and doing the best that we can, but doing well. How about you?
Doing okay. I mean, I think I agree. I think Jason would agree as well. You know, we've all kind of gotten into a new rhythm, a new world order, if you will. What's going on in Cincinnati? Give us a little bit of the lay of the land and how people are doing generally and what's going on.
Well, we've been blessed to have a governor that kind of has led and gotten way ahead of this. And so we've been social distancing like everybody else. And, we're working mostly from homes right now. And as I talk to local hospital and healthcare executives, I can tell you just, anecdotally, I get kind of word and feedback like we were building, to triple or more than that, our ICU capacity, and we're finding that we're only having to do a fraction of that, and that, we were looking to have to build out capacity that would be temporary and maybe at other sites, and that we just don't see that happening right now. So this idea of bending the curve and doing what we need to do and having a governor that has been very, very much a leader, I think, nationally, and just saying, hey, we've got to get in front of this and, make sure that we don't stop it from spreading more than it should. So I think, Ohio, Cincinnati, we're trying to do our part.
Yeah, pretty interesting, right? I mean, to see how, and we've talked about this a ton on this show, Jeff, just sort of how governors have really had to step to the fore. And, Mike DeWine, your governor, it was not easy for him early on because he was a little bit, as you say, sort of out there on his own to some extent.
Yeah, and it sounds like, there's pressure now being put on the governors. And I think that, this whole kind of dialogue about when do we reopen? How does that take place? There's a lot of execution risk that's involved in doing that. And so, as you know, we've been cautiously optimistic here throughout. We unlike previous periods where we were outrageously bullish on the market back in 2018, when everyone else was pretty negative, it was, for us, relatively easy to do that because you could go to the data, and the data was good while the mood was negative and valuation was great. Here you've got horrible data if you look at the economy near term, but you have kind of the cavalry to the rescue here doing the right things on the stimulus front to get us through the gap, and you have the coronavirus kind of curve being bent, but we want to see improvement there. But that keeps you positive longer term that this will be transitory, but I got to tell you, short term, there's a lot of execution risk. So yeah. Unlike that previous period when we were, hey, buy on the dips, get after this, it's a wonderful moment, we're more thoughtful and saying hold your ground, trade up where you can into higher quality stocks for now, but it looks like if we manage this like we think we can, that over the next 12 months, we will be at a much better place.
So, we love talking about names. So tell us where you're trading up. Give us some examples of what you might be shedding and what you might be picking up.
Sure. And, it's funny because sometimes when you do this, people, they'll question, they'll say, why in the world did you do that? I mean, that just feels like moving dirt, Jeff.
I like that. But moving dirt. That's going to stay with us.
Yeah, move that dirt pile. But to us, it was thoughtful and we hope, smart and successful. So an example within consumer discretionary where, you've had a lot of pressure, the retailers under a lot of pressure. We recently sold Best Buy in our flagship strategy and we bought Target. Why did we do that? Well, I recently moved and I had a wall mount, a 65-inch screen TV, and I got to tell you, I want an installer to do that next time. And, it's a thoughtful electronic kind of you know, purchase where you want to go in and you want to test drive these things and see it. So Target, on the other hand, is selling consumables and staples to a large extent, product categories that are selling off the shelves like, you know, hotcakes, and nice dividend yield, nice balance sheet, good management. So we just think that it's, over the next 3 to 6 months, in a much better, you know, part of the curve there. Another example of a trade we did was selling some oil stocks. We sold some EOG. We sold onsemi, which is a auto-related semiconductor stock, very tethered to the auto industry, which is highly cyclical, as you know. And we bought Qualcomm with those proceeds, tethered to 5G, probably a beneficiary of what's going on as we do much more online over time, and again, a beautiful dividend, strong and strengthening balance sheet as they, you know, pay off some acquisitions that they've done in the past, and just, we think, at a better center than auto-related at this time. So those are some of the examples, and I can tell you on the sell side, we did come out of Carnival Cruise and came out of, yeah, you know, Marriott and Las Vegas Sands in anticipation of, you know, what this could mean.
Jeff, when did you do that? You know, when did you do that? How early did you do that play?
I got to tell you, you know, sometimes what they say, it's good to be good, but it's also good to be lucky also. And if you can be both, it's great. So some of those things like Carnival, we were just really disappointed on their execution starting late last year.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And someone might say, oh, so Jeff, you saw coronavirus coming, huh? And the answer is absolutely not. But we did feel we were ripe for some type of correction or pullback near term that would set the stage for a nice advance going forward. And so we thought, you know, names like Carnival, if you did get into a little slow patch, you had a correction that, you know, maybe that would be an area within consumer discretionary, some misexecution that you want to move away from. So some of these things, we bought gold late last year, GLD, also in anticipation of, you know, early in the year we had Iran and, you know, some nuclear concerns and whatnot, some geopolitical concerns. And so we were looking at maybe some stocks or exposure that would do well in rising
right.
global uncertainty. So
right.
we started that early, and then we just continued that, and that's our team continued it through
right.
the period.
Right.
Well, got to say, we appreciate always catching up with you, Jeff, and glad to hear that you are safe and sound. And I
yeah,
got to say,
very thoughtful.
I also appreciate his honesty about calls and things and
totally.
Just being so frank about things. It's
yeah.
just refreshing,
yeah.
to say the least.
Performance proves it. All right,
yep.
Jeff Krumpelman, thank you so much. Chief Investment Strategist, Head of Equities, one of our faves out at Mariner Wealth Advisors on the phone from Cincinnati.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.